This is Claire Spark-Loeb, co-director of drama and literature at KPFK. It gives me great pleasure to introduce the fourth in the series, Women in the Arts. This morning, artist Judy Chicago interviews author and diarist Anaïs Nin on the subject of feminist literature.
Hi, this is Judy Chicago, and with me today is Anaïs Nin.
Hello.
Anaïs,
is this a good test?
Yeah, so they can tell what your voice sounds like. We were talking about how we've always wished we had the opposite voices. I always wished I had a lyrical voice like Anaïs, and she thought she ought to have a voice like mine. So we thought we might exchange. So here, this is Anaïs. Okay, let's start. First question I want to ask you today is, do you think that there's such a thing as a feminist literature?
Yes, I always thought so. I used to read the books. Of course, the women writers that we know already, like George Sand, I used to read the women's books and see a complete difference. And this came out almost more clearly than anything in an argument with Henry Miller and Laurence Durrell, when they insisted that we had to all practice writing Hamlet, first of all, and reach an objectivity and break what they call the umbilical cord. And they blamed me for not breaking the umbilical cord. And that night is the night when I became absolutely aware that there was a difference between the roots of women's art and men's, and that woman was rooted, was much more rooted to nature, was much more rooted to in contact with herself, even though she couldn't always evolve in that sense, but she did have contact, and also with a great many ways of looking at things which the male author had never done.
Often when discussion of female literature or the idea that there's a female art or a distinct way of seeing that's specific to women, that idea is often met with a kind of reaction, negative reaction, mm-hmm. because often people misinterpret that and think that the suggestion of that is that in fact women are biologically different from men. Do you think that the reason for the difference is biological or cultural?
I think some of the negative reasons are what I call programming, are cultural,
mm-hmm.
and some of the things that we have to get rid of. I think some of them are genuinely organic differences which we ought to be proud of and that are not a sign of inferiority, but really are giving a balance to the woman's vision of the world. I think some of the organic things are things that women have felt to be deficiencies rather than an advantage.
You talk about the idea of a feminist literature. Can you, and the idea that there's a difference in the art of men's writing and women's writing, can you talk about some of the women whose work you think exemplifies this point
yes.
of view?
Yes. For instance, Juno Barnes. Very few women have written as beautifully, I think, about the love of another woman in a completely total emotional acceptance of the love. And at a very early time, I think her book came out in 1925. We have called that kind of writing emotional and in a disparaging way. But in this case, the emotion has been transfused with such poetry that even T.S. Eliot had to bow to it, to the expression of it. Then there's other women like Maud Hutchins who are out of print, but who wrote about family relationships in the most completely honest and erotic way, really, and who was absolutely not considered. I think the critics didn't know what to do with this kind of writing. They couldn't only dismiss it by saying it was instinctive, emotional, intuitive. They just couldn't put themselves in the place of the way, the perspective in which women looked at experience,
mm-hmm.
with the body and with the senses, with the whole total personality. Then there's a woman today, of course, Marguerite Young, who has done the most difficult job, what Joyce did in an intellectual way, she did in a totally different way by plunging the stock characters of American folklore into the unconscious and giving a long stream of consciousness book, which is, I think, someday will be studied just as much as the Joyce was studied.
I was interested in your remark about not seeing through women's eyes. Because it seems that if women are the despised in the society, then it would be very difficult for men to allow themselves to become the despised. And what this means is that it would be impossible at this moment in history for men to understand women's writing.
Yes,
do you agree?
I think it's true. I think some of them do. I think some of the men who have are men who have a certain enough feminine component themselves. Usually the artist has understood women, and some of the critics are sensitive to it, now, but usually when they're poets or writers themselves. But usually it's not. And now I'm praising two women have come on the scene of criticism, which show that there's a different kind of criticism. There's a girl called Sharon Spencer. She's a young woman who's written Time, Space, and Structure in the modern novel and has completely reversed the critical point of view. For the first time, she's looking at the modern novel with a modern point of view.
And when you say a modern point of view, what do you mean? You mean a point of view that takes into consideration the female perspective?
Yes, that it does that, and it also takes the away from the 18th century novel, the formal structure of the 18th century novel, what she calls an open open structure.
Who would be an example of that kind of open
structure?
She
has given all kinds of people. She has started with... she's gone through all the Spanish, the French, and the German, and the American literature. She's taken some of the surrealists. She's taken a man like Cortazar, and she's taken some of my work, and there were two or three other women, mainly on the idea of the breaking down of the structure of the 18th century, that is making the real experimental a new form. But we needed a critic. No critic has taken that position, and it happened to be a woman.
Well, if you assume that the 18th century is, I guess, the age of enlightenment and the kind of structure of thinking and the point of view mm-hmm. perception of the 20th century was really born in the 18th century, do you think that's true?
No, I wouldn't say that. From a literary point of view, I thought the 18th century was a very restrictive kind.
That's
of
what
thing.
I meant.
Yes.
What I understood you to say when you said that she was breaking down the 18th century point of view, that the 18th century point of view had somehow continued into
yes,
the 20th century.
In the
century.
criticism.
Yeah, that's what
yes,
I meant.
That's right. And then we misunderstood each other. No, then in the criticism, they continued to apply those rules.
Which were formalist point of view?
Yes, to literature. And it took this woman,
okay.
I think, and as an academic, from an academic standpoint, her work is academic. But it's an innovation that I think only a woman could have done, to consider space, structure, and time in such an open way.
Does this formalist point of view, would this formalist point of view focus on the craft or the structure of the novel and rather than on the content of the novel?
No, it's for the first time considered that the content created the form.
No, the 18th century point of view.
Oh, the 18th century point of view. Well, that was, yes, that was an established rule. There were established rules as to how a novel should be written.
And so,
and also a pseudo-objectivity.
So from that critical point of view, then Jane Austen could be examined as if she was not a woman and only in terms of her craft.
Oh,
is
yes.
that correct?
Oh, yes.
Does that explain the fact that so many women's work have been discussed as if they were not women writing it?
Right, exactly. And then it also explains why we had in modern times women who wrote like men. I consider Mary McCarthy wrote like a man. I consider Susan Sontag writes like a man. There was still this continuation of the tradition that the man had somehow the proper vision, you know.
Now, what about Virginia Woolf?
Now, Virginia Woolf is a different thing.
Yeah. See,
she went into this thing that I call the world that the woman somehow remained close to and did not break from, which is the subconscious, the recognition of the non-rational in our life. And man was precipitated by his own intellectual emphasis on controlling nature. He went much further ideologically in controlling the subconscious rather than allow it to exist. In allowing it to flower, you know, in exploring it. So the artist and the women were the ones who remained close to the subconscious, close in their actions and in their sometimes inarticulateness was part of that because they didn't know how to articulate in rationalizations, which men's world indulged in.
Well,
and you know, they are now for the first time speaking.
Well, what this suggests is that women will lead the way into a kind of an outpouring of the spirit or of the soul.
Yes.
That
they lead the way in a fusion of them. You see, that the intellect shouldn't work by itself, that intuition and the subconscious and the intellect and critical faculty, all these should be are synthesized in the woman. And the woman has maintained, of course, a sensory approach to things with her senses. And she has a greater chance of making a unified synthesis, really.
Well, earlier you said, in relationship to one of the women you were discussing, I think either Dunya Barnes or... That the critics responded to her work as being too emotional. Now, what you're saying is that when women did speak, and they spoke from this kind of nether region of deeper connection with mm-hmm. themselves, then they were dismissed, that was not respected by the kind of rationalist 18th century thinking that you were describing
exactly.
before.
Yes.
Okay, now, if we were to turn the tables and we were to establish a criticism based on what you just described as a synthesis of feeling and thinking that women are capable of, and then we measure books by men on the basis of that kind of critical approach, what do you think would happen?
Well, it'll be a very serious kind of, very serious sort of, turnabout, but which I think is taking place, and which is a necessary swing of the pendulum. I think there will be, finally a harmony of all these elements, but the thing was so unbalanced before. The masculine criticism was so unbalanced by this emphasis on the rational. I always remember a headline in a French newspaper when the underground films first came out. The headline was Le film Papa est fini, Descartes. Is finished.
Uh-huh.
You see, that was the end of rationalism.
Uh-huh.
And they applauded that in the film. Now, uh-huh. we haven't yet applauded that, in the novel.
That's very fascinating. You mentioned before that you recognized that Virginia Woolf was a different story, that she really tried to
yes.
to write out of another level of consciousness and another... Well, she also, besides you, as far as I know, was the only woman writer to discuss in the early 20th century the idea of a female art. That is, she did that in 1928 in Room of One's Own, and you did it, I think, in 1931 in your first diary. And you both discussed this idea of a female art. And when 40 years later, when I was first discussing this with other people, they were shocked at the idea, and so I was really astounded to find that the idea had antecedents all the way back, 40 or 50 years ago.
Yeah.
Do you know of any other women who were either concerned with, consciously, the development of a female art, or who you would consider unconsciously concerned with that?
I think consciously concerned, there was a very remarkable woman called Lou Andrea Salome, that we know very little about because her books haven't been translated into English, but there have been biographies of her. She held out against the ideas of Freud. She held out against the ideas of Nietzsche. She was the friend of Rilke, but really in a way much stronger than he was. And she was in the 1800s, and at that time when women were not even allowed to study philosophy, she almost had a premonition and a prophetic thing about the importance of psychology for women to get rid of her roles. Now, she never played roles. She was one of the most remarkable free women at a time when it was most difficult to be free and equal with men. And her treatment of the men and their treatment of her was on a complete equality intellectually.
Huh. So you think she was involved?
She's one of the remarkable women. She's to me, she's one of the models. She's one of my models, let's say. Could we look for that?
Well, that brings us right to the next question I was going to ask you about mm. models in relationship to the women's movement. That is, obviously, women who have achieved or who are making contributions in terms of an understanding of women's point of view and perspective of reality obviously seem to be able to be models for younger women. I mean, something that I certainly never had enough of, and I think most young women don't have enough of. How do you see your relationship to the women's movement?
Well, the women's movement, let me say first of all that I learned a great deal from it, that having fought all my battles in a way alone or with friendships, because this I always had a friendship with a woman, very close friendships, which we exchanged our difficulties and helped each other and supported each other. It wasn't a group thing which you have today, but it was simply two persons together. But I learned from the movement to be more aware. You see, when you solve your problems individually, you think that some of them are hopeless and you leave them alone. From the women's movement, I learned that there were things that could be socially and politically dealt with. that some of the problems could be solved that way. Also by unity between the women, because my friendships with women, as loyal as they were, there were many women that I wanted to know as artists who for some reason or other did not respond to this kind of fraternity, which I found strange. You know, my first fan letter was written to Juno Barnes and she never answered.
We were discussing that in the car and the kind of reluctance many women feel to identify with other women. At least this has certainly been the case among women artists of the past, even though apparently you've been an exception, and so I think was Virginia Woolf, who was connected with women and certainly with her sister, a painter.
Yes, I didn't know that.
Her sister was married to Clive Bell.
I was always looking for women who didn't receive their due, as I feel about Marguerite Young, for example. I think is a great woman and has done an extraordinary study of the American unconscious, if you want, and received very shabby treatment. And I've been championing her and writing about her and naming her and reading her and doing everything I could. I did have an unconscious feeling. It wasn't very conscious that women were living in a kind of shadow, and that their achievements were not properly evaluated.
Well, do you think that the fact of the women's movement and the fact of a female audience is going to bring to the surface a great number of these invisible women that you're describing?
Yes. In fact, today I was working on volume 5, and I called myself at that time one of the invisible women of literature.
I guess you
were. And then I suddenly realized, when you see that in yourself, you begin to see that in all the women around me. And I still see it today, and I'm much more interested, really. I would like to get off the diary thing for a moment. And I'm much more interested in making profiles of what the young women are doing today, which I find absolutely fascinating. They're able to operate on several levels, as wives, as mothers, professionally, socially, and fulfilling their duties on all realms and creating.
When a couple of weeks ago, Miriam and I did a show on our visits to women's studios and women artist studios. It was fascinating to me because my concept of a studio was a loft or a warehouse. And we went around, we must have visited 40 studios, most of which were bedrooms. Okay, now my first reaction, you see, was that's not a studio and these aren't serious artists. In other words, I had really internalized the kind of masculine attitudes towards what art and an art life is supposed to be. And the male studios, of course, were very separated from their living quarters. But the female studios were absolutely embedded in their life process. You know, they'd go to the market and come back and do some work. They'd take care of things they had to do in the house, and they'd go in and spray some paint, and while it was drying, they'd go off and do something else. Or else their whole life process, the kind of paraphernalia of their life process, filled their studios and kind of spilled over in its abundance into their work. And I began to realize that in actual fact, this life process of the women artists was really much more humanized. And in terms of a model for a liberated society, it was certainly more of a model than the kind of fragmented, schizophrenic life of the male artists who, you know, lived in this bare, kind of dehumanized environment so that he could be an artist, you know.
Yes, yes. He separated himself from human life, so he didn't want to hear the children crying, and he didn't want to be aware of what was happening in the household. And of course I've heard some modern women complain about that the first thing, some couple that I know, when they moved out to New Mexico, he built a studio for himself apart from the house to work, and she has to work in the house with all the interruptions. But these limitations, in a way, restrictions on the woman's life, are also her greatness, I think.
Well, a woman called up after the show and she said that she found it remarkable. She'd never thought of that in her life, that the very things that we have seen as those aspects of our lives that have limited
obstacles.
Us as obstacles, in actual fact, are now being turned around, because what they have done is they have left us with a high level of humanity, which now, if we put at the service of the whole society, will allow us to make a monumental contribution to humanizing the culture.
This is what I really believe.
I really believe that too.
This continuity in the human life of woman, to consider the needs of others, the neighbors, the children, whatever it was that we felt was an interruption, which I, by the way, never resented, is adding a dimension to the work.
Well, of course, then the implication of that would be that if this is valuable for women, then it is also valuable for men. And that the implication would be that men will have to learn how to reconnect in those mm-hmm. ways as human in their humanity that they have been alienated from through their role conditioning. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. And the argument I had with Miller and Durell that day was very significant, because I spoke of their speaking of pride and solitude and acting as gods in creation and all that, and I said, no, a woman isn't going to create that way, not with pride and not with aloneness and not with loneliness and not with isolation or breaking away from things in order to create. I knew that was wrong.
And not with omnipotence,
and argued with them,
is what
yes.
you're often talking
and what
about.
It brought was a kind of schizophrenia, really.
But
because, you know, every artist of my time admitted, the men admitted to schizophrenia, or at least certain aspects of it.
Separation. Of course, the thing about the omnipotence of the artist rests on the idea if the artist is omnipotent, then other people must be below him
yes.
or her.
Yes.
An idea that's very inconsistent with
Absolutely.
The notions, for example, of the women's movement, where you know all human beings will be equal and all human beings will be leaders and all human beings will be artists. Do you believe that all human beings can be artists?
All human beings can be artists. I think children are all artists. We don't know what potential is lost there by education or what is destroyed. We really don't know, because children can paint, and they write poetry, and they do astonishing things as children. They say amazing things. You must have heard that. And I'm always amazed. The symbolic things they say, the things they understand, the intuition of children is far greater, you know, than the parents even are aware of.
I know that the women's movement has... Well, I think, anyway, you have to tell me if this is correct, I think that the women's movement has brought you more recognition. In other words, what you have said has been authenticated by the fact that other women have been speaking.
Yes.
Is that true?
Because occasionally I would make a prophetic phrase, which one does when you're writing unconsciously, that I was speaking for all women. I was thinking of the inarticulate women who surrounded me. But I didn't think of it in larger terms, that I must admit. That only happened when people began to write to me and say they identified with my struggle. They identified with my struggle to grow, my struggle to get free, my struggle to convert what I was learning from men into a knowledge that would be adapted, possibly used to me, you know, of use to me, but it always had to be converted first.
Mm-hmm. Then what you discovered was, in speaking for yourself, of yourself,
yes.
and from yourself, you discovered that unconsciously you spoke for many women who were not speaking.
Yes. And who today write me and say, this is my diary, this is my feeling, except that you're able to say it and we weren't able to say it, and that's all. You know, that's the only difference, really.
Well, what that means is that in truth, the personal has become both the general and the political in your work. That is, you did not have to move out of the realm of the personal in order to speak for many, many women.
Because that fulfilled my wish always, that the personal, developed personal, became beyond the personal and could be useful to the collective. See, this is really what happened, is that when you go deeply into the personal, you really go deeply into the collective, or you have something to contribute to the collective.
Well, what this does is it actually parallels the thinking in the women's movement that the personal is the political. That is, if you have a consciousness-raising group, and if you go around the group and each person gives personal testimony, what comes out of that personal testimony is the fact of our collective lives. That is, it is revealed to us what is our collective experience from personal testimony.
Well, absolutely. No, I didn't realize that. You see, when I was in the diary aware of the wives who gave up their professions for their husbands, of which I knew so many, when I was aware that they were inarticulate, as Durell's wife was in the first diary, and that's what made me say, I'm speaking for you, I wasn't aware that this was a much more universal feeling, that the struggle of woman was a universal struggle. It didn't matter if the background was different or the father was different, but the elements, the psychic elements, the inner voice was the same. It was a struggle to grow against many, many obstacles.
I think one of the most fascinating things in your diaries is the struggle you describe in overthrowing the patriarchal figure in one's head. I mean, I think that in order to generate an authentic self-being as a woman, it was necessary to face down this internalized male authority figure. I think that in that description, you really have outlined the struggle in terms of most women's lives. That is, we have internalized to such a degree male authority figures, and we have seen the world and ourselves through men's eyes,
yes.
and have then responded to those eyes and those wishes to the point that we have many of us lost connection with our authentic center.
Yes, and that may have been why some of us were incapable of friendship with women or admiring women. You see, I admired women. I admired Martha Graham. I admired a great many women artists. I admired the one you mentioned today who works in the desert.
Georgia O'Keeffe.
I admired many painters and today. But I was always amazed that that didn't form a friendship or a cause for working together, you know, an alliance, really.
Well, we were discussing on our way mm-hmm. over the fact that for many women who are dependent for their situation or their recognition on the approval or love or acknowledgement of men, to identify themselves with other women is to risk being rejected by the men, being seen the way other women are seen, mm-hmm. and hence losing whatever position women have. I mean, one of the things we're struggling to come out of is that kind of identification with the male authority figure that you were talking about, mm-hmm. in order to be able to be ourselves and take hold of our lives. I was interested in whether or not the women's movement in the country had an effect on your work. Not, we talked about the fact of greater increased recognition, but on what you actually feel you would like to write or how you write or in any aspect of your work itself.
Well, I think the effect that it had on me was what you said this morning earlier, which is very true, that you reach a point in which your individual development merges with the collective struggle. And the awareness of the struggle being bigger and also of the issue of it also being more hopeful because some of the individual struggles, as I said, there were some things I gave up. I didn't think I could solve the abortion problem, for example, but it could be solved in a mass action, made me very conscious of the present, more conscious than I was, because before what I had for women was great sympathy for her difficulties, but I didn't know all the solutions. What I'm aware of today are the solutions with the women's movement, and the strength of the unifying of the creativities, you know, the activities.
I was interested in your remark earlier today when we were talking about what you said on television in Boston. I think that it would be interesting for you to repeat that story.
Oh, yes. I had to talk... excuse me. I was on a program with Dr. Spark.
But go ahead and have a glass of water. Miss Nin was... talking about being on a program in Boston on television with Dr. Spock, in which she openly admitted that she had had an abortion on television, and the interviewer apparently was very shocked. Is that true?
Yes, I think the interviewer was shocked and didn't expect me to make the statement openly. It happened because I was saying to Dr. Spock that I was thankful to him for at least having supported that cause. And we were talking, and I suddenly made the statement, and I noticed a great shock in the woman.
Well, you said something about how it affected you in terms of, like, realizing that that kind of personal testament from you had a certain kind of significance.
It was the first time I realized that when an artist becomes known, his actions can become symbolical and effective. I didn't realize it would have any importance at all, my saying on television, I have had an abortion. It was necessary to save my life, and I risked my life in having it. I didn't realize that this would affect a whole movement. But this is what I mean. This is what the women's movement has meant to me, this enlarging, widening and expanding of the problems.
We talked also on one of the programs before, Miriam and I, about with several women artists about the whole notion of coming out of the private life into the public life, something I know that you've been struggling with.
Yes, and this is probably the only problem I've had with the group encounters, is that occasionally if I start talking about the individual development in order to inspire them to their own individual struggles, you know, so that they won't feel helpless, it has been slightly misunderstood sometimes that I was putting forward admiration for certain women, which I myself have had. I admired the women who were able to go beyond the obstacle, and I thought that these groups would be interested in that, but some of them feel that this is a threat to the collective activities. And there was a misunderstanding about that, I think.
Well, I think that you were positing mm-hmm. these women first as models, and secondly, in terms of if one woman could achieve, all women can achieve. Is that
yes.
not true?
I was trying to say that, but they seemed to feel that I was saying these are exceptional women.
Well, I think we should not. We should be careful about not internalizing the taboos of society about women achieving, and then not being able to honor those among us who have been able to achieve, like you, Miss Nin, who I really admire and I really love for your work, and I'm really glad you've been there, and I'm glad you've been with us
today
on the radio.
I can say that about you, Judy. I can really say that about you, because I admire your work as an artist, and I admire your articulateness, and I think you've been very effective and very strong in making women conscious of many things. Even I myself talking to you, I've learned from you.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.